Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome to New Books in African Studies. I'm your host, Nicholas Walton. In every program, we talk about a new book that looks at some aspect of Africa and hear from the author. In this program, that book is A Labyrinth of Kingdoms, 10,000 Miles Through Islamic Africa by Steve Kemper. It's the story of a man called Heinrich Barth, who took part in an expedition that led from Libya across the Sahara to Lake Chad and then through the Sahel to Timbuktu. It took him over 5 years, and Steve's book is a terrific account of an expedition that certainly fitted in with the great age of exploration. Here's the interview. Okay, now joining me on the line from, I believe, over in the United States is Steve Kemper, and he's the author of A Labyrinth of Kingdoms, 10,000 Miles Through Islamic Africa, which is quite an extraordinary book about a rather extraordinary tale. It really gives you an up-close view of what exploration was like in the 19th century. It's very easy to think of the great names of explorers and to sort of say, right, well, they did this, then they did that, then they did this, without really capturing what was involved in actually getting to those spots. And in focusing on the life of a chap called Heinrich Barth, who was a German who joined an expedition in 1849 as the expedition scientist, really. Steve is really able to tell us exactly what was involved in an expedition like this. And, you know, it's one of those stories as well, which is just a delight in the telling as well. So, hello, Steve. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Whereabouts are you exactly? Are you in Connecticut?
I live in Connecticut at the moment, which is having Saharan temperatures. We're way over 90 and very humid.
Goodness me. Well, I'm here in London and we'd gladly swap for anything. So, you know, I hope you enjoy that anyway over the next few months. In the meantime, let's crack on with the book. I suppose the first thing to ask is, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and in particular how you came across the man that's at the center of this book of yours?
Sure. Well, I've been a freelance journalist for more than 30 years, and during that time I've focused on people who are breathing, people alive. But for some reason, this guy, Heinrich Barth, caught my attention, and it's the first time I've written a book of historical narrative. I heard of Barth in a book of dispatches from Africa by a famous Polish correspondent called Ryszard Kapuściński, whom you may know about. He
Absolutely,
wrote Shaws.
Yeah.
So he came across a plaque in Timbuktu that said this is where Heinrich Barth, the famous German explorer, had stayed. And Kapuściński went on to say that Barth had spent 5 years exploring the Sahara, that he had been pursued by bandits and murderers, that he had drank his own blood to survive, and that he had brought back incredible amounts of information, which was not appreciated, and he died heartbroken. To me, that sounded like the bones of a great story, and that's how I got interested.
And what? Tell us a bit more about your background before. Had you done any of this type of, you know, sort of looking at Africa, or did the figures that you picked up on, whereabouts were they from?
Well, I've been to Africa a number of times, but it was always in pursuit of stories about living things, never about history. I've never written anything in which all of my sources were dead. So this was my first venture into this. What I was pleased to find is that you still need the same ingredients whether your characters are dead or alive, and that's they have to be strong main characters, they have to have great adventures, they have to have passion, and there has to be some sort of denouement. And that was all there. So I wrote about Barth.
I was about to say your book is absolutely full of all of those things. So actually, can I just ask a question about the sources before we kick off? Was it difficult to piece together this extraordinary story?
The story itself is told in Barth's massive book. So, and he that was a treasure for me because he he makes almost daily entries for 5.5 years about where he is, what he's seeing, who he's talking to. That was fantastic for narrative. What was difficult to weave in was the background, the historical context in Africa, in Europe, to weave in the correspondence from the Foreign Office between the consuls and the vice consuls in Africa and the people in London in the Foreign Office, his correspondence in Britain and elsewhere, the previous explorers, their experiences, things they had seen, and the contrast with Barth. Those were the narrative challenges for me.
Right. Well, I think that this is the point where we can really focus on Barth himself. Can you tell us a little bit about him? Kickoff. He was born in 1821 in Hamburg. He studied sciences and he ended up on this expedition in 1849. What kind of man was he?
Well, he's an idealist. He's completely devoted to science. I think one of his brother-in-law, who was probably his best friend, called him almost a priest for science. He was a difficult character because his life revolved around knowledge and science and collecting information. He was not a very sociable man. He didn't get along well in parlors or in academic departments, for instance. He got along better in the expanses of Africa when he was in danger or being deprived. So, and he was a field scientist. He's an icon for those people.
You during the book, it's fairly obvious that he was at his happiest when he was away from the main body of the expedition. But he also comes across as perhaps a little bit prim and dry humored, slightly over earnest.
I think that's all accurate and fair to say. Yes. You don't read Barth for the jokes.
But then, you know, you read it for the adventure, and there was certainly a great dollop of adventure. Let's just set the scene for this expedition of his. Obviously, this was as you described it, I believe, towards the end of the book, it was the cusp of the age of exploration as it became the age of imperialism. And there was a real lust for opening up the continent of Africa and finding out what lay inside, but also all of the trade routes and trying to find out exactly, you know, what connected to what. And one of the things that you mentioned quite early on is that the an astonishing amount of fatalities had hit expeditions that tried to get into the centre of Africa via the Gambia over on the west coast. And then there was this character called James Richardson, who was the leader of this expedition. Fantastic character himself, which no doubt we can talk about as well. And his view was that if you came south, basically from around Libya, where Libya is now, and worked your way south across the Sahara, although that was a bandit strewn, obviously you're crossing this enormous desert sea, that was the way to get into these areas of Africa that really needed to be opened up.
Yes, that's exactly right. Richardson said, too many people have died in the so-called white man's grave, which is the route through the Gambia. He said, let's go through the desert and try it that way. And so that's what they did.
So the expedition, what did it set out to do? And what was the planning involved, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, the primary goal of the expedition was to scout commercial possibilities for the British. Richardson wanted to find out what Africans wanted in trade goods from Britain, and he wanted to see what they could offer in trade that might be sellable in Britain. So that was the primary goal. In the back of Richardson's mind, the reason for that was if we can get these Africans to use legitimate trade, we can get them to stop the slave trade. And that was his primary motivation. He was an evangelical, very religious man who thought slavery was the worst scourge in the world. And so he thought that the way to wean them off of that was honest commerce. Secondarily was science. And in those days, you couldn't have an expedition without having some scientific element to it. And for that, Richardson consulted a friend of his who was the Prussian ambassador to the court of St. James. And he consulted his friends in Germany because everyone knew that the best scientists in the world in those days were from Germany. And Alexander von Humboldt, who was a famous field biologist, a field scientist, and Carl Ritter, the famous geographer at the University of Berlin, said, the only man who can do this is Heinrich Barth.
And at the time, Heinrich Barth was quite a young man.
Yes, he was in his late 20s at that point. He had just come back from a sojourn of a couple of years around the margins of the Mediterranean, North Africa, the Middle East, Turkey, and then through Greece and back home. So he was a seasoned traveler in part of Africa, and he spoke Arabic.
All pretty important for what came next. So let's continue a little bit with the logistics of this. The whole idea was to set off from what is roughly Tripoli, modern-day Libya, and work your way south. They were heading at one point for the Sudan and Lake Chad, and then they were going to swing across the continent, across what now might be called the Sahel, and eventually end up in Timbuktu. Is that roughly where we're talking about?
Well, that's what happened, but that's not what Richardson planned. The plan was to take a year and a half, 2 years at most, he said, to go down to Lake Chad and then come back through the Sahara. In fact, what happened is what you said. They got to Lake Chad. By that point, two of the people on the expedition were dead, the other two Europeans. Barth decided, I'm going to Timbuktu. He did that on his own.
No doubt we'll talk about Timbuktu later on, because that's quite a fantastic story all of its own. So when they set off on this, what kind of logistical support did they need? Because one of the things that comes throughout the book is just what an enormous undertaking this is. It's not just the danger and the time, it's also the need to negotiate with all of these little statelets on the way, to have enormous logistical caravans, to be carrying all sorts of things, to be able to deal with the horrors that lay ahead. Can you give us a picture of what they set off with?
Well, they had to amass a large number of trade goods in Tripoli, because, as you said, you had to negotiate your way through these lands with the chieftains and the thieves and everyone else who needed to be appeased and honored and so on. Richardson should have known better. He had already done a trip to Africa before, and he'd written a 2-volume book about it in his investigation of the slave trade in the Upper Sahara. But he thought he could do this trip on the cheap, and he caused a lot of heartburn and worry among not only Barth, but the British consul in Tripoli and vice consuls down in the Sahara, because he wasn't really prepared to do what needed to be done to go the distance that he was hoping to go. And it got them into massive trouble.
Can you explain a little bit about that, please?
Sure. When they began to cross the Sahara and decided to go to the district of Ayer, which is a mountainous district, Barth compared it to Switzerland, which is very unusual. No Europeans had been there, and most Europeans had no idea that there were these mountain ranges in the desert. They were beset by Tuareg, well, you can call them whatever you want, brigands, thieves, fanatics. Some said that no infidel Christians will come through our lands. Others just wanted the trade goods. So they were held up, they were picked apart, and they lost about half of what they were carrying before they'd gotten even halfway to Lake Chad.
You have a fantastic quote about the Tuaregs. I've just dug it out here. An anthropologist once noted that for the Tuaregs, the idea that man is free and a brigand is so inseparable that the same verb, I'm not going to try and pronounce it, means he is free and he pillages. I think that kind of sums up their attitude to life, and especially any strangers coming through their territories.
Yes, that is it's a wonderful quote. The other thing about the Tuaregs is that it was not considered stealing. If you had the nerve and the virility and the warriorhood to take things, you deserve what you could get.
I particularly liked some of the descriptions of the Tuareg's attitude to life, where it crossed over with their attitude to women. It was quite an interesting part of the book.
Yeah, that was fascinating. I mean, there are so many things that I learned doing this. As I said, I'd been to Africa several times, and I've read about Africa, and I was really pretty ignorant about things like that. The Tuaregs, unlike almost every other Islamic society, give women freedom, great freedom. They don't cover their faces. The men cover their faces. The women can own property, and if they get divorced, they take their property with them. The husbands join the wives' tribe. The wives do not leave to join the husbands' tribe. The wives eat with the men. The wives eat with the visitors. There's no. It's a very easy relationship between the sexes. That's totally different from everything else, and it's partly why the Tuaregs were so fascinating to European visitors.
Throughout the whole of the book, Barth and the other people on the expedition come through a succession of extraordinary statelets that all seem to operate according to all sorts of different organizational principles and so on, their politics, their economics. You know, some of them use cowrie shells as the basis of their currency, and some of them are organized along Islamic principles, and there's emirs and there's everything. I mean, this was just the most fantastic part of the book, because it was every single place had its own character, and every single place was a new element of the adventure.
Yeah, that's very perceptive of you to pick that up, and that's exactly what Barth brought home. He wanted people to understand that Africa is not just the dark continent, that in fact it's got every imaginable shade and every possible metaphorical meaning of that phrase. These places were independent, they were organized, they had their own cultures, their own traditions, and they were different from each other. And no African would say, I'm an African. They would say that I am from Gwandu, or I am from Bornu, or I am a Kanuri, you know, I am a Fulani. So that's the distinction that Barth brought back, which I think is so important, and which, to tell you the truth, I think most people in the world still don't understand.
To be honest, it was a bit of an eye-raiser for me, an eye-opener for me. Can you just tell us a couple of the anecdotes about exactly what it was like when Barth or his colleagues started off in a place, or came across a new place?
Well, there were so many different... It just depended where they were. Often, if he came into a new place, you would first have to see the emir or the sheikh or whoever was in charge. And you would be assigned a house. And after you were assigned a place to stay, then came the ceremonial gifts, first usually from the African side. They would give them camel loads of rice, or they would send over a bullock. And in return, the infidel travelers were expected to shower the great ruler with expensive gifts. And so that's how it started.
And in some of these places, it's quite clear that Barth was really scrabbling around to try and find things worthy of giving to the emirs, and desperately worrying what it meant for his actual health if he wasn't able to fulfill the emirs' expectations.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because the Tuaregs had taken so much of the stuff already, and what he had left was often of not high quality, and because Richardson hadn't bought enough stuff. And so then... Often these rulers would say, well, fine, but you're not going to leave yet because you haven't given me enough stuff. And by the way, here's another bullock. So that means you're further into my debt.
Yeah. But this was a crucial element of it, because to actually negotiate these vast expanses full of bandits and what have you, it was so important to be able to win the patronage, in a sense, of the rulers of these little states that sat on trade routes, because that at least gave you some protection. In these vast expanses, I mean, you're talking about a couple of hundred miles very easily between these things. So if you weren't able to stock up with whatever was necessary and maybe have that, you know, that kind of guiding hand behind you, then you're even more easy prey to the bandits, let alone to those people who sat on the trade routes.
Yes, that's exactly right. And for Barth, it was a double dilemma, because it was not only his survival. It was his ability to make progress so that he could do the science that he wanted to do. And without the goods, you weren't moving. And that's why he was so upset and anxious about whether the British government would give him more funds, because Richardson had spent everything before they got out of Tripoli. And they were out of money. They couldn't buy any more goods. They had been robbed of much of what they had. And so Barth is in this frantic position of, because he is now the director of the expedition, Richardson is dead, he has to get more money from the British so that he can continue. And meanwhile, of course, the communications take 6, 7, 8, 9 months before Barth could hear anything back.
It's extraordinary, though, that he was able to send things out. I mean, for instance, towards the end of the book, you're talking about how he was trying to find out how he was going to move on from Timbuktu. So he sent letters north up to Morocco, out to the west coast of Africa, and also to the south coast of West Africa. And these letters, as you say, it was a question of send them off and wait several months before they even arrived, let alone, you know, pick up the fruits of whatever they were able to achieve.
Yeah, and at least in that instance, they knew where Barth was. A lot of times he was on the move. So you're trying to, you're waiting for these letters to get to Britain, to get approved, to get the goods together, and then to get them back, to find a caravan who's going in the general direction that your last letter came from, and then the caravan has to find you, and you have no doubt moved along. So, and yet they almost always did find them. That's one of the extraordinary things, because the grapevine in the desert was so accurate that the news got passed between caravans who met each other. Have you seen the infidels? Well, yes, they were. You know, they were south of Bornu. You know, that sort of thing happened all the time.
That's extraordinary. It's a bit like when we were talking about all the different statelets and how they were all developed in their own ways. Just the efficiency of the trade routes is also another thing that speaks of a. It's a different type of development, but my goodness me, it's there.
It certainly is, and you know that reminds me of the markets, which is a good example of this. Barth was stunned to find European goods every place he went in Africa. In Timbuktu, at Lake Chad, there would be swords from Germany, there would be silks from Britain, there would be glass from Venice. It's extraordinary that all of this material was making its way into territory that Europeans had barely set foot in, but the traders had gotten the goods there.
One anecdote you tell is where he appears in a market, and he starts spotting goods that were stolen from him a month or two earlier.
Yeah, that's a very funny. Barth, of course, Barth saw the humor in that. James Richardson did not see the humor in that because he ran into it as well.
I just wanted to talk about some of the things that they, when they embarked from Tripoli, or when they set off on this great journey, what type of things did they take with them? You know, what type of trading goods was it advisable to take with you when you were an explorer in the 19th century setting off south to Lake Chad?
Well, what was advisable to take and what they took are two different things, unfortunately. Richardson took a lot of cheap goods that he bought in North Africa. And those were not very acceptable to the rulers because they could get that stuff easily. Barth said you should have brought British silverware, British razors, British manufacturers that are hard to get inside Africa. Richardson didn't do that. Barth made a request once he was the director, please send me a couple of cases of silverware, watches, music boxes, telescopes, looking glasses, things like that. Those were the things that were valuable. And then, of course, clothing, manufactured clothing. Not so much cotton cloth, because the Africans were very good at producing their own beautiful cotton cloth, but other sorts of clothing. And he also did a good business with pins. Pins of different sizes were very helpful trade goods because they were rare in Africa.
And needles.
Yes, needles. That's what I meant to say. That's exactly right.
Oh, right. Okay. And the one other thing that struck me about this journey was that you describe the towns that sat either side of this massive expanse of desert almost being like ports, which, of course, you know, it straight away makes you realize what the Sahara must be like, to think of it as a great inland sea that's only just about navigable. And when you hit the other side, suddenly you come across this extraordinary trading zone, very analogous to a port on the side of a sea.
Yeah, that's. I think that's exactly right. I believe that Sahel is an Arabic word for coast, and they literally considered that Sahel, which is the band that runs in between the desert and green Africa, as the coastline. You were either embarking into the sea of the desert, or you were disembarking into the Sahel to go south to trade. So it really is an inland sea made of sand.
Let's talk about what James Richardson was obsessed with, and that was the slave trade. At one point you write that Richardson was forced to abandon his view that if you could only convince the whites to give up slavery, and then the coastal Arabs, which were the conduits of the slave trade from the interior of Africa, then everything would be fine and everyone would give up Africa. But what he found on this expedition was an extraordinary amount of indigenous slavery that he suddenly realized how difficult it would be to eradicate.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. And it's something I didn't understand very well until I did the research for this book. Most of the slavery in Africa was domestic slavery. It was slavery within the black kingdoms. And they raided the pagan tribes who were not Muslims, therefore they were legitimate slaves. You weren't supposed to make a slave out of a Muslim, but it was perfectly okay to do so with pagans. And that's who ran massive farms for the powerful black kingdoms. That's who did the housework. That's who planted the crops. They did everything. And Richardson realized it's not just the Arabs, as you said. It's systemic and it's entrenched. The other thing to mention about it, though, is that it's very different from the kind of slavery that I know about from here in the States, which was industrial and traumatic and horrifying in the American South and in the West Indies. In Africa, Islam treated slaves very differently. They could own property. They could marry a free woman, and their children were born free. Things like that were really surprising to me. So it was a very different type of slavery.
There did seem to be an enormous number of categories of slave, and almost that depended on which little statelet you were a slave in, I suppose. But some of the scenes, much as you draw a distinction between that and the far more kind of industrial type of slavery, which was part of the transatlantic slave trade, there are some extraordinarily harrowing scenes that you paint a picture of.
Yeah, you're talking about the razzia, the so-called slave raids, and they are horrifying. There's no two ways about it. They tended to kill the healthy males because healthy males were too much trouble to transport. And what they really wanted were the women for domestic duties and for duties in the harems and so on. So there is that scene in the book where Barth is watching 200 men, young men, with one leg chopped off and they're bleeding to death in front of him. I can't even imagine that scene, what it must have been like. Barth responded by describing this new tribe, which he had just been introduced to in this horrifying way. He described their physiognomies, what they had on, what they wore in their ears. It's chilling and horrifying.
And there are also an enormous number of children taken.
Yes, of course. Yeah. And the children often were separated from their mothers, from their parents. That was not permitted if a slave was born while you owned a slave, you couldn't separate the mother and the child as they did in the American South. But they could separate them after the slave raids. They divided up the booty, and the children may not stay with the mothers.
Can you tell us a little bit about something that, well, you come across it, especially if you look at the Ottoman world and so on, but the practice of using eunuchs and actually how they came about to be eunuchs, I found to be particularly horrifying.
Yes, I don't think any man can read that section and not shrivel a bit. The Muslims, it was not permitted to castrate slaves or anyone in Islam. So what the Muslims did is they sent these people to castration centers, some of which were run by Coptic monks, or they bought eunuchs from pagan kingdoms, or received these eunuchs in tribute from pagan kingdoms where it was not illegal to castrate. So, and the way they did it, of course, is horrifying. Everything comes lopped off. They use hot butter or hot oil to stanch the wound. And according to Barth, only 1 or 2 in 10 survived this horrifying operation. On the other hand, there's the quote in there about an explorer named Dixon Denham, a British explorer, who was horrified by the sight of a couple of freshly castrated eunuchs. And the chief eunuch of the court said, "What do you care about these people? They're dogs, they're enemies. They should be dead, and now they'll spend their lives living in a palace amidst luxury."
I'm not sure that would have convinced me, but I can see the argument. But this actually brings us to why eunuchs were so important, and this was because of the development, for instance, of harems. And if you had a large harem, sometimes as many as 50, and you do mention in the book that that then led to problems of being able to satisfy all of the young women in the harem. If you wanted anyone to look after this or guards within it, it basically made a lot of sense to have eunuchs.
Yes, because they were no sexual threat. So they're the perfect guard dog for a bunch of young, beautiful women. Imagine living among these temptations that you can never enjoy, and so that they were compensated with power and with money, but a horrible existence. And of course, the concubines often hated the eunuchs because they were tattletales. Their job was to control them. And by the way, 50 would be that would be a modest man. The Haj Bashir had over 400. Approximately. I think that's hilarious that he had to make an estimate of his number of wives.
Extraordinary. It's like a rich man trying to count his bank accounts, I suppose. Can you tell us a little bit about the science involved? Obviously, Barth was a scientist. That was the reason why he was involved in the expedition. You did get scientists involved in expeditions. That's how Darwin, of course, ended up going around the world on the Beagle. But can you tell us exactly what he was looking for, what he was keen to find out, and of course, what the successes were?
Well, I think Barth was primarily a linguist and a historian and what today we would call an anthropologist. So he was looking for links between cultures and places. He was looking for the way that places influenced culture and shaped cultures. And he was looking for linguistic clues, for links in that way, as well as historical clues. So he wanted to study the people and why they were the way they were, and link that to where they were living.
And what exactly did he discover? What was it of note that he was particularly pleased with?
Well, he had some geographical discoveries. He discovered the upper Benue River, which and proved that it did not flow into Lake Chad, that it was the major tributary of the Niger River. That was a major geographical puzzle that was solved. He also discovered a couple of kingdoms that no one had ever heard of in Europe, Gwandu and Hamdalahi. He discovered that the language that is peculiar to a town called Agadez, which is in the eastern part of the Sahel, was very similar to a language spoken only in Timbuktu, which was far, far to the west. And it turned out that historical incidents linked these two things, that the Songhai Empire had conquered both way back in the 14th or 15th century, and had left garrisons in these towns, and the garrison, the soldiers had mingled with the local populations. The languages had a hybrid language had been created, and they were similar to each other, even though they were very distantly separated. The way, and you mentioned Darwin, it's a bit like Darwin's finches. They're related, but how did they these islands are far separated. How did they, why are they, how are they related?
What's extraordinary about this is how he was picking up so much information, and then he was in this, you know, he reached the Lake Chad area, which is exactly what he was planning to do. And then he decided to, in a sense, turn right, go west, and keep on going. When you were writing the book and researching the book, was there any kind of clue about what was it that drove this man to, instead of go back after risking his life for so long and suffering so much hardship, just to sort of say, right, well, I know, I'll prolong this whole thing by what was obviously going to be months, years, and yet he kept on going. What exactly was driving him?
He doesn't say precisely, except that my speculation is that he felt that he had not accomplished enough yet in the expedition, although he certainly had. He'd made all sorts of excursions from Bornu on Lake Chad to kingdoms all around the lake. But he wanted to go to Timbuktu because that was the place that had the allure back in the mid-19th century. Only one European was known to have reached there and survived, René Caillé, a Frenchman. Mm-hmm. And it was irresistible to someone like Barth. He wanted to trace those cultures, and then he wanted to see what Timbuktu was like. And he just could not resist going to the next new place. It's what made him a great scientist.
But you're talking about how long? Sorry, let's go back. How long had he already been on the road by the time he made this choice that he was going to push on to Timbuktu?
Well, I think this was about 2.5 years is when he decided. So he was already far beyond the maximum expectation that the expedition would take. But he said he wanted to go. He asked permission, and the British government, to its credit, said, yes, we would like you to do that, and we'll fund it.
Right. And this brings us to a perfect chance to talk about Timbuktu. It's a mythological place that even children will know the name, but it exercised a bit of a hold upon them, the imagination. As you said, one person, this French chap, had been known to get there. There was another guy who got there beforehand, a British guy, who then died not long afterwards on the way back. The French guy won a prize. I think he won the Legion d'Honneur or something like that as well, but eventually died in poverty after his claims were questioned. So why was Timbuktu such an extraordinary place with such a hold on the imagination of what we thought of as the West?
Well, I think it goes back to Mansa Musa, who was a great emperor of Songhai. And he made a Hajj to Mecca, across Africa, through Cairo, and over to the Middle East. And he took with him camel loads of gold. His retainers were carried gold staffs. He dropped a lot of jack all over Africa, Cairo, the Middle East. And this got back, the news was, it was spectacular news, and it got back to Europe, and it created this rumor of golden cities in the middle of the desert. So it was a dream to find the golden city and no doubt to profit from it. In reality, Timbuktu was and is a sandy desert mud town, and its real riches were in its Islamic scholars and its libraries, and that remains true today.
Although, as we speak, there is news of Islamic extremists in Timbuktu destroying some of the great monuments of this great age of Timbuktu.
Yes, that's just horrifying. And it's not the first time. Timbuktu is used to it. It's been swept by conquerors throughout its history over centuries. And it's not the first time that, in fact, that books have been destroyed, that libraries have been broken up. But it's just terrible that it's happening again.
But to go back to Barth and this great age of exploration, it must have been a bit of a disappointment when you'd read all of these stories about, you know, the El Dorado of the Sahara. No one quite knew exactly where it was. And when you actually got there to find that it was, as you say, a bit of a dusty outpost, must have been quite a disappointment.
Well, yes, it was. For René Caillé, of this Frenchman we talked about, he had devoted his entire life to this dream of getting to Timbuktu. He wasn't a scientist. He was simply a dreamer. He was inspired by the story of Robinson Crusoe. And he learned languages. He impoverished himself. He went through horrible, horrible trials and tribulations in order to see Timbuktu. And when he got there, he could not believe that his dream was a pile of mud huts in the middle of the desert. So it was disappointing, although he did get honored for reaching there and surviving.
Well, his voice, his life story sounded almost as extraordinary as Heinrich Barth. As we said, you know, he was honored, and then everything was called into question, and he ended up dying at, what was it, the age of 39 or something?
Yeah, the British were part of that. They spread rumors that perhaps Kaye had not really reached the city, that he had just somehow found the journals of the British explorer who had gotten there before him, but who had been murdered just outside the city's gates. And they accused him, and Kaye was no scientist, so he didn't bring back any useful information. All he did was go there and get back. And the British, you know, so they cast doubt on it. This infected the French perception, and, you know, and as governments tend to do, when you're a hero and you're no longer in the news, it's safe to cut off your pension. And that's what happened to him, unfortunately. So it was a mixture of things. And he died brokenhearted and broke.
Yeah, a very sorry end. But to return to Heinrich Barth, 5.5 years later, 5.5 years after setting off, 10,000 miles of, you know, what counts in anybody's book as quite extraordinary adventure, he ends up back in Britain. He's pretty well received, to be honest, but the adulation stops far short of what we might have expected. And this is the big question that lies behind your book. This was the great age of exploration. We had Speke and Livingstone and Stanley, Burton, the rest of them, and we all know about them. And then there was this, yes, he wasn't necessarily the most all-consuming personality that you might ever have come across, but what he actually achieved, both as an explorer and a scientist, was pretty extraordinary. So did you ever get any closer to working out why we haven't heard of him as much as we ought to have done?
Well, as you said, he did get honored by the British government. He did get honored by the Royal Geographical Society and by various societies in Europe. But there are a lot of things that I think contributed to him not being famous. And no single thing accounts for it. But when you add them all together, they create a sort of fog that hides him from the public. One is that his book was too long and too boring for the public to digest, especially in comparison to David Livingstone's work, which was exciting and dramatic, or Richard Burton's books, which were also scholarly but were heavily dramatic and exciting as well. Barth wrote as a scientist, and it did not appeal to the public. He was also German, and I think that had something to do with his reception by the public. One of the greatest expeditions in English exploration was led and succeeded because of a German. I don't know, and that seemed to stick in the craw of some people in the Royal Geographical Society, for instance. So there was that aspect of it. Barth was also very critical of the government in his book, saying that they didn't support me the way they should have. I spent way too much time deprived and so on. That's not appreciated, because the British government really did make extraordinary efforts to support Barth in Africa. It was just too difficult. The style of was changing, the interest of the public, because of Livingstone and Burton and those explorers. The public was more interested in the east and south of Africa and less interested in the Sahara. So Barth had sort of gone geographically out of style. There was that as well. And then I think partly it's what he came back and said about what he had seen. And it didn't fit in with the growing feeling that we need to take Africa. We need to civilize Africa. Their only hope is European civilization.
Mm. that fits in with all of the different civilizations that he came in across on the way, and that they're in some cases extraordinary level of development.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to justify taking over someone and pillaging them and imposing your ways on them if they have a civilization of their own. It's much harder to do that. You can't justify calling them undeveloped, uncivilized. And you know, there were many parts of Africa that were that way, but certainly this part of Africa was not. It had long historic systems of government, commerce, organization. It was all there. And yet, because Europeans and America had been there, we would have done the same thing, by the way. We did it with our Indians. We treated them all the same. You know, you treat them all the same. It's Africa and Africans, and there weren't distinctions made.
Well, Steve, it's a terrific story, and you've done it terrific justice with your book. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But before we say goodbye to you, I'd like to just check up on what you would say your favorite place in Africa is. Have you had a good think?
Yeah, I did think about it, and I'm sorry I'm going to have to give you two answers.
That's okay.
For nature, it would have to be Masai Mara, because it's so gorgeous, and you can see so many iconic African animals there. It's majestic, and the Maasai, it's iconic Africa to me. But on the other hand, for gritty Africa, I really did enjoy Timbuktu. It's a special place, and because of the history and because it's in the desert, and it's just picturesque and tough at the same time.
Fantastic. Well, I've never been to Timbuktu, but I've got photographs of my own childhood playing with cars in the dust in the Masai Mara. So although I can't remember it that well myself, I probably share your view on the first one. So thanks very much indeed, Steve. Are you working on anything exciting now, or are you still dealing with this particular project?
No, I've got another book contract about another historical obscurity. This time he's American, but he also worked for the British again. He was in the Boer War and did a lot of work in Africa and in East Africa as well. So it's another historical adventure coming up. And by the way, thank you very much for your thorough reading of the book.
No. As I said, it's a terrific book. Really, really enjoy it. And it's a book that, you know, some of the ones that we do are slightly more academic, and some of them I've spoke to a woman called Erin Haney, who'd done a fantastic book of collecting photographs from the 19th century and the 20th century about Africa, and this just sort of fits in with all the other ones that I've read. It was a real joy to read, so thanks very much indeed for writing it. Fundamentally. But thanks very much indeed for speaking to us. It sounds as though your next projects would be very well worth hearing about as well. So when you get in, when you've finished writing that, it's been published, get back in touch.
I will. Thanks for the offer.
All the best. Enjoy the good weather.
Okay. Goodbye.
And that was Steve Kemper talking about his book, A Labyrinth of Kingdoms, 10,000 Miles Through Islamic Africa. If you're listening from the website, you can subscribe to this and other New Books podcasts on services like iTunes. And if you're on iTunes, then don't forget the website. This is Nicholas Walton from the New Books Network, wishing you a good day from here in London.